Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective. They post episodes on Tuesday and Friday morning, bright and early. The NBA playoffs are here, so be sure to check it out. You can follow Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective, as well as The Right Time, wherever you get your podcasts. Also, The Ultimate Fighter, the reality show that brings top MMA prospects together under one roof to compete for a UFC contract, is back. Stream the season premiere on Tuesday, June 1st, only on ESPN+. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, look at those fans back in the stands in the NBA. I'll tell you why that's important. Also, we've got the final installment of The Right Time Book Club on Kane Mutiny, a book on the Miami Hurricanes football dynasty. We'll talk to the author of the book, Bruce Feldman. But first, all right, NBA action, playoff actions, fantastic. It is back. Gabe, you get a chance to indulge in some playoff action. Did you watch your Lakers get their asses kicked on Sunday?
Yeah, I did. So thanks for mentioning that.
Just checking. Like, I just wanted to make sure you were okay. You know what I'm saying? That's why I was asking. I was just kind of checking on your feelings, making sure that you was, you know, you was in the right place. I don't think it's a big deal that they lost that game, really.
Yeah, I'm not worried yet.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
Keyword yet.
Yeah, I don't think if you're the Lakers, you got any worries unless you lose game three, right? Whether you win game two or not. If you go home down 2-0, I don't think that's that big a deal, right? And of course, obviously, if you lose game three, you're down 3-0, it's a big deal. But even then, if they split these games in Phoenix and then they wind up down 2-1 after losing game three, okay, now we got some measure of concern. And like as of right now, we don't know just how bad that Chris Paul shoulder situation is, because it looked like he couldn't do nothing with the arm yesterday. And I don't care if he went vegan or not, he's still 36 years old. Like, I don't really have no great explanation, a great answer for you about what kind of healing he's going to do. It sounds like that vegan life makes it easier for you to heal. I don't know. But like, that's what we're going to see, is what he looks like. Devin Booker, a guy I've been somewhat, I haven't even been critical of Devin Booker. Like, I got myself into a thing on the tweets one day. A lot of Suns fans were harassing me about this. Is when Devin Booker didn't make the All-Star team and everybody was whining about Devin Booker not making the All-Star team, and everybody whined the year before about Devin Booker not making the All-Star team. And I phrased this poorly, but the thing was, I was like, I think Devin Booker's a fun guy to watch, but I don't think that Devin Booker is like necessarily this game-changing player. And what I really meant, I probably should have put it differently, was like, Devin Booker not making the All-Star team doesn't bother me. You know what I mean? Like, it's not as though I looked at who the guys were that made the All-Star team and it was like, how dare you put this guy in over Devin Booker? He is very popular, and I don't mean like they just like him as a dude, but like his game is like very popular with other players and with like a certain class of analysts and the likes. But I think he's one of those guys that was kind of at the fringe of being an All-Star. Like, that's just kind of where I put him at.
Do you think that other players like Devin Booker because he's like a good like second or third option? Like, he's kind of like a Bradley Beal light?
I think that there's a certain type of game. So in every industry, there are people that are not necessarily the biggest in the game or the most successful in the game, but the people who are in it, like, specifically respect what it is that they do. So, like, I feel like guys who are just, like, dead-on scorers tend to get more respect from their peers than they do from observers who are inclined to go look at numbers and look at what their actual impact is in a way that can be quantified and stuff like that, right? So, Carmelo Anthony, I think, is a great example of this, where players themselves, because his one-on-one game is so cold and so sophisticated, there's a particular respect for the things that he can do. Kobe Bryant, I think, is another example of that. A guy that when you go into like the advanced numbers, it doesn't go so well. But if you're a person whose job it is to go out there and get a shot one-on-one, then you have a different respect for some of the things that those guys are able to do. And I think that Devin Booker is in a similar space. And I think he's a pretty good playmaker, right? I don't think he's really doing a whole lot of guarding nobody, but he's not my guy in that way. Again, I think he's kind of like in the way that you talk about Bradley Beal, who I think is a, as much as he puts up all the points, right? But I think he's just totally a volume scorer at this point. But he'll get you some buckets, but I think he's like a fringe all-star type of player. Like those years where he doesn't make it, I don't think it's as offensive as other people find it to be. But Devin Booker looked good in game one. And the Suns overall looked good. Like what they look like best case scenario for a Chris Paul team, right? And I don't want to take any credit away from Monty Williams as the man coaching that team. But they look like Chris Paul went out there and told y'all what it is that y'all supposed to do. And y'all going to go out here and y'all going to do exactly what it is that I told y'all to do. And they do it. They're a very good offensive team. They're a very good defensive team. DeAndre Ayton, who I think in the eyes of a lot of people will always be the dude they took instead of Luka because they wanted somebody who went to Arizona. But he's still good, right? And with Chris Paul there in particular, like one thing that I think that we knew when Chris Paul got to Phoenix was if he could turn Tyson Chandler into like a reasonably credible offensive threat. Not a guy you're going to throw the ball to when he makes moves, right? But I can get Tyson Chandler the ball in places where he can do something with it. If he could do that with Tyson Chandler, then DeAndre Ayton was going to be cake. Like, that wasn't going to be hard to do at all. And what do you have, like 21-16 in game one? That's what he brought out there. So Phoenix looks good. Getting back to people I've been kind of critical of, on the other side, Gabe, your boy Anthony Davis. You remember last year when I said that thing about Anthony Davis with PJ Tucker, where I was like, you just can't keep letting these people push you outside? And then people got mad at me about that. And then Anthony Davis turned it up after that, right? Like he was a much better player. But this is what would worry me if I was the Lakers about Anthony Davis. What's my man's name? He covers the Pelicans. Mason Ginsburg. He made a great point on Twitter looking at some numbers. His point was, last year in the playoffs, Anthony Davis went on a run of jump shooting, unlike anything he had ever done in the NBA. Right? He had his best month and change of shooting that we have ever seen. And if you want to know how good that month and change of shooting was, Ginsburg broke down the last 3 years of what Anthony Davis did on long twos and on threes, and then compared that to what he did in last year's playoffs. So for the 2018-2019 season, 34.1% on long twos. The 2019-2020 season, 32.2% on long twos. The 2020-2021 season, 32.1% on long twos. And the 2020 playoffs, 55.2%. Okay. On threes, 18-19, 33.1. 19-20, 33. 2021, 26.2. In the playoffs last year, 38.3. Right? Like it was a totally anomalous performance from Anthony Davis as a shooter. And see, to me, that matters because if he's going to let people push him backward, then he's going to have to shoot at that rate that he did in the playoffs last year. I am not a professional basketball player. However, if I had to offer a hypothesis, I would say that for most guys, definitely for some, shooting in the bubble was going to be a totally different animal than shooting in these playoffs, right? It just seemed like it was a much better shooting environment because there was so little going on. There was so little distraction. The atmosphere wasn't the type that, like my buddy Howard Bryan always makes the point about the playoffs, 15-footers or 18-footers in the playoffs, right? The bubble was just a totally different, unique set of circumstances. And so I mean, that's what I look at when I see Anthony Davis in this one thing that was totally not like the other, shooting way better. Well, it looked like they were tall manning him in game one, right? He wasn't looking like big man. He was looking like tall man. And Andre Drummond, big man, they couldn't play him. I would not be surprised if after game two, he doesn't play again, right? They didn't play Marc Gasol. Montrezl Harrell is so tricky because he's so bad at playing the pick and roll that you kind of got to figure out what to do because they're just hunting him every time down the floor. Did you see the play at one point? Booker had the ball and he was looking for somebody to set up the pick and roll. And I forget which, I think Ayton was coming to set the pick and he was being guarded by, I think it was Drummond. And he's like, no, not you, you. And he points to somebody else. They want to get the switch onto Harrell, right? And the thing about Harrell is one of those guys that is like the advanced numbers love, right? Like he provides when he's out there, but he's just got a fundamental weakness, which is he's really bad at playing the pick and roll. I don't know how you're expected to function in the NBA these days if you are a center who cannot protect the rim. Either be able to protect the rim or play the pick and roll. And I don't think Harrell's good really at doing either one of those things. Those are the things that I got to worry them. But the whole equation for the Lakers is built on the idea that they have two superstars and we will cobble together what we need from the rest of these guys. Anthony Davis thereby has to play like a superstar. There's no room for excuses as to why you're not playing like a superstar. You have to be able to play like a superstar if the Lakers are going to have a chance to go deep. And in fact, have a chance really to win this series. Because I think the thing about Phoenix in particular is the thing with Utah too, although Utah's going to be a little tricky because I don't know what's going on with Donovan Mitchell and that ankle. But if the Suns and the Lakers were playing in the Western Conference Finals, I don't think anybody would pick the Suns. Right? Like, we would lean on the Lakers' experience. We would lean on the Lakers' star power. And by that point, they would have had like two rounds in the playoffs to demonstrate to us that they could do some level of winning or whatever. I don't think any of us would pick the Suns. In the first round, little bit of a different situation, right? The Lakers, not look so great. Coming toward the end, we don't know what it is with LeBron James. You know, like, maybe this is the chance that they have in order to get this done. I think the thing that's going to be really helpful for the Suns, and I think this is where Devin Booker comes in. One of the things about Chris Paul teams, now he's had these injury issues in the playoffs basically the last 6 or 7 years, right? But the thing about a Chris Paul team is he typically has to have the ball so much. And there's a danger in trying to run your team around a guy his size if he's got to have the ball so much. But Devin Booker can initiate the offense. And Devin Booker is not Chris Paul's size. He is much bigger than Chris Paul. Can you like move Chris Paul off the ball and alleviate some of those concerns? Think about that Rockets team, the one that had a chance to beat the Warriors until Chris Paul got hurt, right? You got James Harden who can then do those things and at some times let Chris Paul be a secondary playmaker. And it alleviates some of the concerns that you have about a little guy having the ball that much, right? These are the interesting things to watch with Phoenix, but I thought they looked great in the course of their game. I thought really for the most part, I thought most of the games over the weekend were really good. The Nets-Celtics game was good for the first half and not so much the second, but I thought it was a decent enough game. Denver, so I can put Denver and the Clippers together in this part of the conversation, right? I've been saying when people weren't listening, like when nobody was around, that I saw the West coming down to the Clippers and the Nuggets, except the problem is they're the Clippers and they're the Nuggets, right? Like the Clippers. It ain't like the Clippers got dudes that ain't never done nothing before, right? They got damn Kawhi Leonard, Paul George. I mean, he hasn't made the NBA Finals, but Paul George has done a lot in the NBA in the postseason, like at least on teams. He's been here. He's seen this. And then they went out there and got beat by the Mavericks, dog. And, I mean, they beat the Mavericks last year in the postseason. It looked kind of like this at points. Luka looked great, and as Luka has gotten the shooting right in the second half of the season, like, now Luka's becoming the player that y'all said he was before, right? Like, we're moving into that space. And the Nuggets, I don't think the loss of Jamal Murray is as big a deal as other people have made it out to be, right? Like, I think that losing Murray then allowed Michael Porter to take on a bigger role, which I think he was ready for, right? Like, if they're going to need a second star player, I think that second star player is Porter. I don't think that it is Jamal Murray. It's not a shade to Jamal Murray. I just feel better about Porter. I feel better about the big guys generally. However, Gabe, do you know who starts at point guard for the Nuggets? Campazzo, P-A-Z-Z-O. I think it's Frank Campazzo. I think they call him Frank. It starts with an F, and he's Argentine. You're not up on him, are you?
Man, sounds like I missed out on adding him to still in the league.
Still? How would I have ever known he was in the league in the first place?
I know, so I would have gotten you then.
Yeah. I'd have been like, who in the world is he? Well, he played 30-something minutes in game one. Like, he's there. Right. They are so good on that front line, right? Like, I feel like if they were to get into a series with the Lakers, right? If the Lakers won their series and the Nuggets won theirs, they would play next. That front line of Jokic, Porter, and Aaron Gordon requires that LeBron James guard somebody, right? Like, it's demanding. But their backcourt ain't hitting on nothing. Like, it looks like they're going to have a time with Portland just for that reason. Their backcourt ain't hitting on nothing. But I thought the Wizards played a strong one against the Sixers. In a way that I would not have expected. Hawks and Knicks, that was a strong one. The Grizzle came out here, got them that victory over the Jazz. Like, I thought we had just across the board a lot of really good basketball. And the best part about the playoffs, I know it's going to seem ironic to people, but them scores are coming down and that's good. right? Like these video game numbers, these 135s and everything else. No, these numbers look reasonable, right? Like you're seeing that intensity turn up, right? Like it looks and feels. Last year's playoffs didn't feel like the playoffs. They kind of look like the playoffs. Now these feel like the playoffs, and I'm here for it. Speaking of that, why do they feel like the playoffs? Well,
spring is the best time to add new challenges to your training, just in time for summer and warmer days. I've been in the gym a little bit trying to get my fitness in check so I can break these skinny allegations I keep getting. And spring is the best time of the year to take a new look at your fitness routine, dial it up a notch, and continue powering on. Peloton has everything you need to get you where you're going. Whether you prefer to run outdoors, row, or ride at home, or strength train at the gym, Peloton has something for you. Peloton's varying class lengths were designed with your training plan in mind. Personalize your workout. Whether you'd like to add a 10-minute core session at the end of your strength class or take a 60-minute power zone ride to increase your endurance. Peloton classes are designed to help focus on your needs and goals while challenging yourself at every level. Now you can catch up on your favorite NBA games with NBA League Pass while you push yourself to new levels of fitness. Watch your favorite games and win your workouts with NBA League Pass on Peloton and visit onepeloton.com. Peloton All Access membership and NBA League Pass subscription required.
Yo, it feels like the playoffs because people are back in the building. I am one of these people. I feel like in my industry, we do too much to make fans feel important, right? We do too much to make y'all feel like y'all the ones doing something out here. You know, we basically turn fans into the equivalent of that asshole kid in class who says, "Hey, I pay your salary." You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, we all knew that kid. Like, that's what fans are. I pay the tickets. You don't buy the tickets that fuel nothing. You get the cable package, maybe, that fuels something, right? But a lot of this is fueled by people that don't never watch a game. They just pay for it on cable, right? However, as far as the television product goes, I said this before everything shut down, that I thought it was going to be harder to watch the games just because you don't realize how much the people are part of the television production. You know, like the fans, the energy, everything else. All right, so now we're getting people back in these games. Now, the thing is, you can really only hear them in a lot of arenas right now. And the difference in hearing them is kind of but so much just because we've been piping artificial fan noise in for so long that I don't think that that is necessarily a difference. Like, that's the ambient noise track. You know, like that's just kind of what it has become. However, this is something interesting that I noticed about the games. Most of the arenas are still set up right now in such a way that the camera shot that we primarily get, like that left to right shot that we normally get, on the other side of the far sidelines, there still aren't seats, right? Like the players are still sitting spaced out like they were, and people put like backdrops or things they can advertise there behind, you know, the scores table as it exists there. But you don't see the people. Now, what you're seeing, though, is on the near sidelines, you can see in the arenas that's really got people in them that they packing those seats up, right? But what they're still not doing yet, and I understand this for a number of reasons, but they're still not doing yet, we're not getting those crowd shots, right? Like they're not panning into the crowd after somebody hits something big, you know? We're not doing that, except for one place, Madison Square Garden. They are giving you all the crowd. That game felt different to watch on television than any other game. Now, part of it, of course, is that it's Madison Square Garden, and Knicks fans, bless their hearts, they're so happy right now. I'm just happy for them because they're happy, right? Like, they're just so happy. But for whatever reason, okay, and this isn't just about networks because TNT broadcast that game, but I watched TNT broadcast other games in the course of the weekend, and they were showing those crowd shots. Oh, they showing them at Madison Square Garden. They giving you Tracy Morgan. They giving you Jon Stewart. They giving you Spike Lee, and they were giving you the crowd shots. Now, what they got going right now at Madison Square Garden, and I think they have the same thing going at Barclays Center. Both places are letting 15,000 fans in for the game. But they have a vaccinated section and an unvaccinated section. And the vaccinated section is the one they packing in deep, deep. They got so many seats up close, So many seasons, they getting this money back, dog. They going to do whatever in the world it is that they can do. And I'm thinking about that, like for courtside seats or like that lower level to go see the Knicks right now. Given what they were charging people to see the Knicks when they were sorry, I can't imagine what they can charge coming out the pandemic, right? And the Knicks are actually in the playoffs. I can't imagine how much money they hitting people up for. But damn if it didn't feel different. Damn if it didn't feel better. Like, it was great for us to have that, right? And I don't even think just because of, oh, we're healing, we're coming back to normal. Man, I ain't give a damn about y'all and that stuff. I'm just talking about watching a basketball game and it feeling like a playoff basketball game. And that's what that Knicks-Hawks game felt like. With another level, by the way. Me and my man Vinny were talking about this. I think he's writing a column about it. But I was talking last week with Foxworth about how the league kind of has an absence of villains. And it does have an absence of villains. Wrestling can't be all faces. It's got to have some heels, right? And the NBA doesn't really have heels because nobody's been building up this brand since they were 14 to become a heel, right? That's not really how it goes. Oh, but we got one. And I don't know if he's a heel to everybody. I know he's a heel to me. And that's your boy, Trey DeBarge. Gabe, are you familiar with DeBarge?
I am not.
DeBarge was a singing group. Whole string of DeBarge brothers, right? Like, they had different bands, all kind of stuff, right? Rhythm of the Night, you know that song, right? Do-do-do-do-do-do. All right, that's them. That's the DeBarges. Now, what I want you to do right now is Google DeBarge, D-E-B-A-R-G-E. And when you get a look at them, I believe that you will understand why I call him Trey DeBarge. I'm going to keep talking, and then you can just jump in once you see what I mean. So anyway, I hate Trey DeBarge's game. I told him, oh, Gabe, there's that face. Doesn't Trae Young look like he could be a DeBarge?
Yeah, I just think we need like maybe a little switch up on the facial hair.
Yeah.
Like a little mustache maybe instead.
Yes, yes. He could definitely be a DeBarge, right? So I hate Trae DeBarge's game so much. And you know why I hate Trae DeBarge's game so much? All that damn flailing, right? He is the new James Harden. Because let me tell you something, and you tell me if I'm wrong here. Because I feel like I've watched a decent bit of the Nets with James Harden, but he just got back, so I don't know. James don't seem to be doing all that nonsense this year, right? All that insurance fraud, he don't seem to be doing as much of that. Trae Young is a scammer. Trae Young is running all the insurance fraud all the time. And at least with James Harden, I can halfway understand some of his insurance fraud because he's so big and strong. Guys like him, LeBron, like, I mean, I'm not putting him in the same category as LeBron and Shaq, but you get where I'm coming from. You're not going to notice a lot of the fouls they take because they can shake them off. You know, like they do kind of have to sell it a little bit. Trey DeBarge actually gives me a whole new respect for Steph Curry. Think about this. Steph Curry, I can't name another legitimate superstar caliber player who does not play into superstar calls other than Steph Curry. Like Steph never became that dude. Maybe in part because cats can't even get their hands on him. But he never became that dude that was out here flailing and all this stuff and everything else. And that's what Trey DeBarge be out here doing. And I hate it. But what I do love about Trey DeBarge, though, is Trey DeBarge is going to the basket. Like, he is going to try to get a bucket. But, of course, you're going to do that after you demonstrated yourself to be a scammer. Everybody's afraid you're going to call the police. You're going to tell the teacher whether I did something or not. You know, like everybody think you're going to get out here and do. And they were booing him to no end in that crowd. And when he hit that bucket for the Hawks to go ahead, take the win, giving them the shh, and he cussing right back at him and all that. This is what we need, right? Like, I can say I hate Trey DeBarge's game, but the game better for Trey DeBarge being there. And my understanding, by the way, is that his peers ain't so wild about his get down neither. I also think Trey DeBarge is just a bit overrated. Like, there's just something to me about guys that we swear are such great shooters, and then you go look at the numbers and you realize they don't actually shoot that well. By the way, Brad Beal is a guy that's in that category. He had a couple good years shooting from three, but other than that, he's just kind of an average three-point shooter, but he shoots a whole bunch of three-pointers, right? But he looks like what we think a scorer is. Trey DeBarge came in here and thought that he was Steph Curry, like shooting these half-court shots and everything else. There are two guys in the league that can do that, man, Steph and Dame. The rest of y'all need to be working on getting better shots. And the Hawks, they look good, right? They looked well coached. They got talented players. And this is a big one for them, to me. DeAndre Hunter is shaping up to be a dude that can get his own shot. And if DeAndre Hunter can become that guy, given the caliber of defensive player that I think he's ultimately going to turn into, and if Cam Reddish like starts getting it together, the Hawks might have it. Like, they may have everything they need to put together. But do they have, like, a future superstar? No, because I don't think Trader Barge is that guy.
And they banked on it being him, right? With not taking Luka.
Not taking Luka. Yeah, they did. They did. They did. And they're the ones. It's funny. The Suns, they're not the ones that's really going to have to answer for it. You know what I'm saying? The Hawks, they fell right to you. And you were like, nah, y'all can have them. Y'all can have them. And no, Trader Barge is not Luka Doncic. I would absolutely, there's no way in the world if things were halfway equal and they were playing the same position that I'm picking like the 6'2 guy over the 6'7 guy. Like it just wouldn't have been that for me if I was going to make that move. But that was the decision they made. And so let us watch as New York City comes to hate Trader Barge. Like it's here. It's there. And I don't know how many people they're going to be letting in the game in Atlanta. I would imagine they're going to let more people in the arena than they got seats because ain't been no pandemic in Atlanta. They like, what pandemic? Here's what you need to watch out for when we start talking about fans in Atlanta, okay? New York is deep in Atlanta, all right? And I've always made this point to people, and I don't think that people quite get this, but this is the truth. When people talk about how it is that at Hawks games throughout all this time and everything, there'd be more fans for the other team than there are for the Hawks, right? Got it. But it's the same thing that I've been saying about why I didn't think the Raiders should have moved to Las Vegas and what their concern needs to be is that if you are a Raiders fan, you got 8 chances to go to Las Vegas to watch the Raiders. If you are a Chargers fan, you got 1 chance to go to Las Vegas and see the Chargers. Therefore, the Chargers fans are going to be willing to spend more money to go see the Chargers play in Las Vegas than the Raiders fans will. So they're going to be playing a lot of road games by the time it comes up, just because that's how incentives work. And that has happened a lot with the Hawks, where especially with folks from like New York, there's so many transplanted folks down there. They get more charged up about going to see their team on top of all the segregation issues and everything else that comes from Atlanta. Anyway, the point I am making to you is New York going to be deep, I imagine, at these Hawks games. And by the way, it's the worst kind of New York that's going to be deep at the Hawks games, right? Like when you're in New York, New Yorkers are pretty cool. When you're in New York, New Yorkers are friendly. But the ones that y'all export to like our other places, we hate them. They're the worst. All they want to come do is talk about how much better everything is in New York, right? Like that's all they ever want to do. And all they got to their name is that they from New York, right? Like that's their badge of honor. The coolest thing about them is that they from New York. And those are the people I went to college with, all of them. Hate the guts. Can tell you how much you come to hate. You hate the guts. Anyway, they gonna be deep at whatever they call it now. State Farm, I believe, is the name of the arena now. They're going to be the ones that's in there. I need all the rappers, man. All y'all. Y'all got to turn out, man. Y'all got to do something. Y'all got to give free tickets away to the kids or something. I don't know what it is, but if you want to prevent an infiltration of ass, we're going to have to figure something out because otherwise that is what Phillips Arena is probably going to wind up being. By the way, Gabe, did you see that some restaurant in Atlanta apparently turned Dominique Wilkins away talking about dress code? They claim that he did not adhere to the dress code. And so they turned Neek away. You see what I'm saying about these out-of-town ass coming to Atlanta? Like, I don't know if those people are from, you know what I'm saying? All I know is this. Ain't nobody with no legit Atlanta about them. And I always tell people, I'm not from Atlanta. I was born there, went to college there. I grew up in Houston, but I know it, you know? Only person I ever seen shut the mall down was Neek. Like, just by walking around, only person I ever seen shut the mall down. They turned Dominique Wilkins away at a restaurant on your classic historically racist, and maybe these people weren't being individually racist, but the dress code in general is a racist game to play. They turned Neek away. Neek, you got to be from out of town if you turn in Neek away. And by the way, yo, Covington, yo, Kennesaw, that's all out of town too, right? You got to be from out of town turning Neek away. Either way it goes, Hawks fans, I'm just warning you what it might come down to. Because this is going to be an interesting scene in that arena. All of it. Fans, welcome back. Seriously, we missed you. The Right Time with Bomani Jones Book Club is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Counseling. Visit BetterHelp.com/Bomani for 10% off your first month of online therapy. It is our final episode of the Right Time Book Club. We had Spencer Hall join us before, Alonzo Highsmith, Joel Anderson, and now joining us, the author of Kane Mutiny, and sincerely, one of the reasons why I'm here doing any of this stuff. He was great to me when I was a younger guy, Bruce Feldman of The Athletic. What's going on, man?
Hey, it's great to be on with you. I really appreciate that. That makes me feel so good to hear that.
Oh, seriously, man. Like, you answered my emails. It made me feel like I was a real writer. And that will always be, like, a significant thing for me. And I remember one thing is, it was kind of around the time that this book came out that I had kind of made your acquaintance, and I read it, and somebody who was of that time who loved it. And we've gone through most of the first part of it, but something we really haven't talked that much about so far in the book club is the 2001 Miami Hurricanes, which are at this point easily one of the top three most talented teams of all time. And that Butch Davis basically put together with magic tricks.
He did, because he really took over when they got nailed with scholarship sanctions and everything else. And you talk about that 2001 team, and it's come up a little bit more because the last national title team that Alabama had in 2020 was just so dominant. Now, granted, it was different challenges, certainly in a pandemic, and it was pretty amazing what they did. But just think about it, like, Sean Taylor was a really good player on that team, but he was not a guy, like, he was a, you know, obviously he was a ridiculous talent, but they had Ed Reed, they had like three other first round picks in the secondary. He was a true freshman. Vince Wilfork was a true freshman. And those guys were, it is going to be a high bar in terms of the legacy of what those Canes did. I mean, Ed Reed is arguably the best college football player I've ever covered. His personality just carried that program through time of change, from certainly from Butch to Larry Coker. And I think Larry Coker was one who started out winning 34 games. And I think a lot of that was because the leadership in that locker room was so strong. I mean, they were very lucky. They got Ed and Reggie Wayne out of Louisiana, and they got a lot of guys that other people maybe didn't want. Dan Morgan wasn't on the 20. He left in the year before, but he was a guy who was like a linebacker. A lot of people, you know, weren't sure what he was. And he went there and he turned out to be a great player, and he bought in. And, you know, you talk to guys like that, and they have such a bond because of, they came from all different places and all different backgrounds. But what Miami was, what the U was, it resonated with them in ways that maybe you look at that profile and go, oh, that kid probably would have gone to Penn State, or that kid would have gone to Notre Dame. It's like, no, that kid felt like he was a Miami guy. And that's why I think it all worked, and their locker room was so good at that point. You know, it was hard to keep that lightning in a bottle, though.
Yeah, it was also interesting that those guys felt like they were Miami guys while Miami was also kind of trying to move away from what Miami had been. And Dan Le Batard would always tell me that, like, that set of guys would always say out loud, no, we don't want to be those guys. But those guys were why they wanted to be, you know, with the program.
Right. And I know, you know, you had Alonzo on, you know, Alonzo, Melvin Bratton, those guys are the godfathers of the U, really. And there's a bunch of guys like that. And I think sometimes the perception of what Miami was, because they embraced the black hat so much in that day and age, you know, it's crazy to kind of look back. Because if you remember, I was almost too young, so I know you were too young for this. But like the juxtaposition of Miami early 80s compared to Notre Dame, or Miami, you know, against Penn State, it was like the good guys, the perceived good guys against perceived bad guys. And it's like, okay. And then you start to look back at maybe the perception of that Penn State team, you know, with some of the stuff that has come to light, not necessarily about the players, but about the leadership there. And it's a different prism, you know? And I mean, it's like, you take a look, even like Lou Holtz was going up against Jimmy Johnson. I mean, you know, people saw Lou Holtz in a certain light, and they tried to see Jimmy Johnson in a different way. And, you know, look, Lou Holtz is the one who pretty much every program he left went, you know, had NCAA issues of some sort. So it's just like, I think the perception of what it was, how they embraced it, they didn't care. And I think Dan has a, you know, from growing up there, has a good feel for how it connected with the community at a time when, you know, I don't say Miami was in flux, because I think a lot of places are in flux constantly, but I just think that it was really changing in a significant way. And so the connection they had there, I'm not sure if that can happen again, you know, just because of all those factors.
Yeah. And it was interesting that after 01 in your book, you know, kind of closed at an interesting time, which is the 2002 season where they won all those games. But it was obviously, like, for people who have a more modern memory, it was like 2014 Florida State, where you looked at the team they had the year before and there was no reason why they couldn't dominate the next year, except they didn't, right? They won games, but it was obvious that there were signs of slippage. And then it was really 2004, I feel like, was the year after that, that it all just kind of fell off the table. And now we're at a point where there's a whole generation that has no idea why we talk about Miami the way that we do.
Right. And so I remember pretty clearly when I started working on the book, I got approached by some literary agents. And I remember being at that Fiesta Bowl. I remember some of this clearly, like being near Warren Sapp, who would have his like white towel that he'd kneel on, you know, like every play. And you're sweating it out whether they're going to win or not. And I'm thinking, you know, it's almost like having a bet where you're thinking like, if Miami doesn't win this game, I'm going to lose. And I don't know, you know, like whatever the book advance was going to be. And I'm thinking about it that way. And then they end up losing, and it's just like an emotional adrenaline dump for that team in a profound way. I remember going around the locker room and talking to players, and Jared Payton, who's obviously the son of, you know, legendary Walter Payton, you know, back then, I don't know, I was 20 years old, really thoughtful. And he also, by the way, ended up having like a great game when they, probably their last really good game on a big stage, they beat FSU in the Orange Bowl. It was like kind of the last hurrah, because it wasn't, by Miami standards, that game didn't matter because it wasn't for a national title, but it would matter now because it was the equivalent of like, you know, a BCS bowl or whatever. But one of the things that came up in the locker room a lot was a lot of the guys in here don't know what it took to get here. They only saw the top end of it. And what you had a lot of, Bomani, was a lot of three and out guys who were just so talented. It's like, get into the league. Like, I feel like Miami was one of the first programs where it became a real thing of, hey, we're doing three and out and we're going, because these guys ended up having great, you know, they were going to be first round picks and they were going to have, you know, great careers. And I think somewhere it got lost about helping build the program, because it had been the Reggie Waynes and Santanas and Ken Dorsey's and Dan Morgan's and Nate Webster's. Those guys knew how bad it was. I mean, a lot of them either were recruits when they saw Florida State just blow them off the field, or they were freshmen playing way before they should have. And so that group kind of saw it. The guys who came in after, it's not to say that their heads were in the wrong place or they were ill intentioned. They just didn't know. And I give credit to, somebody we both know, Eric Adelson, who I work with at the magazine, ESPN Magazine, a long time ago. And he said, before anybody I had heard, said, this is not going to work out for Larry Coker. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's won, you know, at the time, like 30 games in a row. And, you know, it worked because he followed a guy who, it worked early on because the locker room culture was so good because of Ed, especially, and some of the other guys. But eventually they needed a stronger voice in there. And Larry Coker, God bless him, was the right guy at the right time. But that time was pretty short. And so what surprised me a couple of years later was Randy Shanning becomes the head coach. And I'm thinking, this is going to work out, because almost every coach who's come through Miami has won a national title. The only one who really didn't at that point was Butch. And Butch probably did the heaviest lifting outside of Schnellenberger. So I'm like, Randy knows this place in and out. I know everybody knows how smart Randy is. Everybody, you know, inside the place knows how smart Randy is. He gets the program. He gets the kids. The problem was Randy could never figure out, you know, like he went through like 10 offensive coordinator choices before he ended up hiring who he did. And then I just think there was a lot of stuff that was working against him that, you know, it just kind of kept fizzling. And they've been in now they've been in kind of a downward spiral, just chasing stuff. They're chasing magic, which is hard to do.
Yeah, and I always felt the Miami football program, like a major difference between Miami and, say, Alabama, is that the administration wants it as bad as Nick Saban wants it at Alabama. And at Miami, they've been glad to have it. Like, it's good. It's done things for them. But you never get the feeling that they wanted it, like from Thad Foote all the way down. You just never got the feeling that they wanted it.
Right. And so the Thad Foote piece of this, and for people who maybe haven't read the book, there was so much of he wanted it to be Ivy Leagues in the worst way. And yet he also was trying to take the icing off the cake, especially, you know, there was issues with Jimmy, no doubt. And Jimmy pushed back in a profound way. And I think after a while, look, I give Mark Richt some credit, because Mark Richt didn't work out great on the field, but he raised money and he upped the commitment to the program. You know, as like an inside baseball thing, sometimes, you know, you wonder, okay, why did this 5-star go to X program and leave or whatever? And it's like you start to hear rumblings. It's stuff you can't report because it's innuendo or it's rumor. But you know, if you've covered college football or covered college sports enough, you know there's some stuff that goes on. And the one thing I would say is that, you know, it's like they are committed to football at the highest level. That is like the euphemism, meaning like that's the workaround, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that the head coach is dropping off glad bags full of cash somewhere. It just means that somewhere along the way, like Miami does not have, it was ironic, the Nevin Shapiro scandal, because Miami doesn't have a lot of boosters like that. And if they have boosters, they don't, like, they're so about the program that they're not going to slam the program in a way that like, oh yeah, they're going to rat it out of stuff I did kind of thing. Whereas other programs, I'm not saying everybody's cheating across the board, but there's stuff that goes on with like a wink and a nod. And those are things that are happening. And it's just like, hey, that's the cost. I forgot what the, maybe it's a Godfather line. That's the cost of doing business, right? And they reap the benefits of it. And I just think Miami's always been kind of new to it, right? And even the way everything unfolded, you look back at like some of this stuff and it's like, okay, you know, I think we all know Luke and some of the things that he got tangled up in optically. I mean, I think it's stuff that is kind of small peanuts compared to some of the stuff you've heard about in that day and age. But it was like, okay, this is how Miami is trying to reconcile it, right? Because I feel like there's just such a disconnect between what the Miami brass has typically been compared to other places.
You know, I've always felt like Miami could bring it back just because there's so many great players in that area. But I think an interesting trend, I was curious to ask you about it. You also wrote a book called Meat Market about the recruiting game that I think has been lost, is that local recruiting isn't what it used to be. Like, you know, the schools that feasted just because they had so many good players in proximity. Texas is a great example. And now Ohio State's coming in and taking all the good players out of Texas. Like Miami was largely able to do this because they had so many good players around and nobody really knew it at the time. Well, now everybody knows it and everybody's showing up.
Right. And I think the key thing is it really does become a domino effect. So Luther Campbell, who obviously, as you know, is really like the godfather of South Florida football, especially in youth football. And some of the guys he knows, like there's a guy who's on the FAU staff, Chris Perkins, and who is like Ja'Cory Harris's coach and worked with Teddy Bridgewater and, you know, knows these kids when they're kids, right? And so you hear stories of a Amari Cooper who works out as a junior in the spring and Al Golden's staff doesn't see it. I mean, they see it. They don't. They're like, you know, kind of shrug their shoulders at it. Luke takes him and a bunch of other kids to a camp tour around, basically, I think, around the Southeast, but ends up at Alabama. Nick Saban gets it. He sees it. He does not care that at the time this kid was I don't know if he was a 3-star. He might not have been rated yet. He sees it, jumps in the boat first. And then all of a sudden it becomes, you know, it leads to Calvin Ridley. It leads to Jerry Jeudy. It leads to a pipeline, which Miami's had some good skill talent, not great, like relative to what it used to be. But it's like there are so many good, and you can't keep them all, right? But there are so many good skill guys in South Florida, and very few of them have gone on to have great college careers at the U. It has been a while. And so you look at that, and either they've chosen the wrong ones, because that particular year, and I don't want to say who the kid was, that they were like, okay, that's the guy we're targeting. And I think that player had like 16 catches in his career. You know, it's like you look at, I mean, I use those three Alabama receivers who are from South Florida. And I feel like, and it's probably too much of a generalization, but I feel like those three kids, I think they all came within like 2 or 3 years. They put up ridiculous numbers, and then that kind of begets Devontae Smith. It begets Henry Ruggs. It's certainly, you know, Jalen Waddle, all those guys, because you remember it wasn't that long ago. I feel like Julio was the first wow guy for Alabama at receiver, and then all of a sudden they've gone on this crazy run. And I mean, look, hats off to Nick Saban. He's the best who's ever coached in college football. But a big part was those guys, you know, ended up there. You know, sometimes I think so much of it is just, are you evaluating the right people? And some of that competitiveness, I remember being around Amari Cooper, and I'm not going to say I know him because I really don't, but I remember being around the Heisman and asked, there was a couple of things he answered to questions. And I was like, wow, that kid is wired differently than almost everybody else in terms of he is burning competitively
Like, he knew who like the 9 or 10 receivers were who were ranked above him. He also knew, I'm not going to name those guys publicly here for you because I'm not embarrassing them. So it was like, it worked on both ends. It's like, okay, how old are you again? You know, it's like, you got that guy who, you know, looked facially like he was 18, but thought like he was 35, and have those guys in your room. And unfortunately, like I said, from Miami side of it, they miss those guys. And then it's like, you're missing the next one and the next one, because those other guys now all of a sudden know, hey, I can be seen everywhere at that program and everything. Because I don't think it's so much like a facilities issue. I just think it's not like, oh, they have this great weight room or they have this or that. I think it's more about like, you know, where do I fit? Where do I belong? I think those great players see it in other great players.
All right. Now, I want to ask you just two kind of back in the day type things about this to wrap this up. One, something I think that gets lost in the Miami story, especially with the 80s and early 90s, is there were a lot of heartbreaking defeats in there. Like, as good as they were, like Alabama, since Nick Saban got there, has lost 2 games by double digits total, including the first season where they lost all those games. That's it. 84, Miami suffered the worst blown lead ever. And then the Doug Flutie game came after that. There was the Fiesta Bowl loss. There was the 92-1 with Alabama. Like, I think the part that we forget about this story is actually a story of resilience at a lot of points.
Right. And look, you mentioned two of them. Like, everybody kind of knows probably about the Fiesta Bowl. And, you know, Vinny Testaverde throws a bunch of picks and the defense dominates. But, like, the Doug Flutie play around Thanksgiving weekend is arguably, you know, as celebrated in college football lore as any other. And then, you know, just from a, ooh, comeuppance, you got embarrassed, you know, Lamar Thomas, you know, gets walked down by George Teague in a play that's like, for a lot of people who hate Miami, that is probably one of their favorite plays in college football history, right? Because of that's Miami getting shown up for its bravado. Hey, you're not as special as you think you are. And those are happening on big stages. And then, as you mentioned, you know, I think it was Frank Reich was the quarterback at Maryland. Now, I feel like a little bit with that one, that was kind of before Miami had arrived. You know, the Flutie one probably was too, you know, whereas George Teague and Lamar was, that was, Miami was already, you know, the peacock at that point, right? So,
but even 88, right? The fumble.
The Cleveland Gary fumble? Oh, my God, yeah. Like, if there's replay now, Miami wins that game, and Miami wins, you know, is winning another title or whatever. There's just so many rich layers to, because you could look at it from the other side and go, well, the wide rights that Bobby Bowden lost to Miami on. But at the same time, you know, I even think about, like, this is in the 2000, they play at Husky Stadium. Neuheisel is the coach. I think Marcus Tuiasosopo is the quarterback. That was a loaded Miami team, and they had a couple of things that just kind of went against them. They don't get into the national title game. I think FSU did. They end up going to play Florida and thump them pretty good. And it's like, you know, if that had broken a little differently, they're playing in the national title game, and I don't think they're losing.
Right. Now, the last thing I wanted to ask you, something I did not realize until very recently. I don't know how I did not. I did not realize that you went to the University of Miami. What was the campus like at the time with the football team?
Full disclosure, I went to 5 schools. I was not a good student. It took me 6 years to graduate. And so I transferred in there. There's a good story here, but it's too long. And I should tell you offline because it takes too long about when I first transferred in there. But anyway, when I got there, what I remembered a lot was baseball at Miami was a big deal, bigger deal than it is at most college campuses. Ron Frazier was the head coach, and it's a small campus. I don't think people realize how small UM is. And when I transferred in there, and I don't know if it's exactly like this now, but a lot of the students came from South America, or it's very strong Spanish-speaking population. I remember my first class, this is an odd story, but I was an art major when I got there. My first class was, I transfer in there, I'm coming from upstate New York, and it's like, I take a class called Art of the Human Form. And if somebody's sitting there going, oh, you're transferring to South Florida, and you're going to take a picture, there's going to be all kinds of nude models, and ooh, that's going to be something. What you don't realize is most of the nude models are elderly people who are doing it for like $50. It was an interesting mix, and football was very much, part of it almost felt like it was like the Dolphins kind of thing, because, you know, it's not an on-campus stadium. The old Orange Bowl was very unique, and it was loud as could be. It's like, honestly, it's the loudest football stadium I've ever been in when it's rocking. Now, I'm not talking about when they were playing Rutgers or Temple. I'm talking about when Florida State was coming there. But it was just a very different vibe, you know? And the thing I kind of gather is because I had a bunch of football players in my classes, and it wasn't like, I didn't see like, you know, raging entitlement or anything like that. I just thought it was very small, right? And so you kind of keep going back to that as how different it was than, especially now I go to these colleges and most of the college campuses are enormous and that's the college town. Well, that's not the way it is at Miami. You know that. It's a very small part of it. And keep in mind at that point, I think we just got college hoops back, but it was, they were not very good. I think the Panthers were just about to come down there, but it was like, it was a very different, I don't think we had the Marlins yet. It was so, it was a, just a different sports town, right? And so people at that point got really used to Miami then being awesome at football. You know, it was just, that's how it was. Like I went to school with Mario Cristobal and, you know, we talk about it a bunch now. It was random, was like my TV crew was doing an Oregon game. And so I went over to his house. He was not the head coach yet. He was the offensive line coach for Willie Taggart. It was Taggart's year there at Oregon. And it was crazy because I went over to his house for dinner and Carlos Huerta, who was a really good kicker for Miami, and Matt Britton, who's probably as tough a guy as Miami had. He was like not a great player. He was a solid player, but he was one of Mario's buddies from high school and played at Miami. So they were over for dinner and the U was on. It was like, it might've been the U too, but it was kind of weird to watch it with the guys who lived it, you know, and they had their own great stories. I feel like what the U was, the doc was, I felt like it was like basically three chapters of my book. And then, you know, you just had these amazing storytellers. But I think what people don't kind of connect is just how small of a school it was. And that's, I think, part of what made it in some ways pretty improbable.
If you didn't say it, I was going to, that, yeah, the U was kind of your book. It was.
Hey, listen, here's one thing I learned about money. It was like, I remember getting an email from John Walsh's assistant. And can you come in? I was living in Los Angeles. Can you come in for a meeting? And so I remember like Keith Klingscales, it was Keith Klingscales, Walsh, a couple of executives and the guys from, I think it's Raconteur. I forgot what the original is called. And they grew up there. They were huge Miami fans. The conversation was kind of like storyboarding what this was going to be. And I remember sitting there going, okay, this is basically the same stuff I had gone over in my head for like a year. Right. And I'm not saying I didn't, you know, have a lot of help of like editors or whatnot, mm-hmm. but those discussions, I remember saying like, if you get Melvin and Alonzo, you got it. Because those guys are great storytellers and they'll help you get somebody else. And then, you know, there's other guys you get like, Gary Stevens was Miami's offensive coordinator. He made me meet him at some hotel bar. He gave me great stuff, but every time he was going to tell me a great story, he goes, hey, shut that damn thing off. And I'd have to shut the tape recorder off. And it was like, I think I was met with him for like, you know, four drinks in a couple of hours. And I got, you know, very little for the book because it was all off the record, you know, but I could always say, hey, Gary Stevens told me this. And then I could go to somebody and get it. It was just a really interesting time because it's Miami. You could talk to like 300 guys and get some amazing stuff. You pick your spots. I mean, in retrospect, I would have liked to have done that book probably 10 years later in my career because I would have been more experienced to know how to do it and
probably more organized and just have better experience because it's just such rich material, as you know.
No, absolutely. And that is the Right Time Book Club. That is Bruce Feldman. Check out Kane Mutiny and, of course, his other fine literary works. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this now three times a week. Gabe Bassan and Tony Collati, you'd handle things behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. If you only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.